This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehayas Ruhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I mean, there's a proliferation of innovation happening in this space now in Kenya as a result of the infrastructure to provide zero carbon electricity.
That's Jake Levine, Chief Climate Officer at the United States Development Finance Corporation, on how his agency has funded green power projects in Kenya. Details coming up also. Two army colonels are charged with inciting a mutiny during Madagascar's presidential election. And we'll have coverage of the funeral of former U.S. First Lady Rosalynn Carter. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Hours before a truce in Gaza expires, international mediators are working to extend it to facilitate the release of militants held hostages and Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. The six-day ceasefire has paused the deadliest fighting between Israel and Palestinians in decades. Israel has agreed to extend the truce, which was originally set to expire on Monday, by one day for every 10 hostages freed, and Hamas is expected to release another group of hostages later today. So far, Hamas has freed 81 of the more than 240 hostages taken on October 7th, when Hamas and allied militants attacked Israeli communities. In turn, Israel has released more than 150 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. It also has allowed more aid and fuel into the Gaza Strip, which has been under blockade since October 7th. The Israel Defense Forces today said it is investigating reports that a 10-month-old Israeli hostage, his 4-year-old brother, and their mother were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. Also today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said President Joe Biden's administration would like to see a new extension of the ceasefire agreement after the current one expires tomorrow to secure the release of more hostages and to ramp up humanitarian aid deliveries to Gaza. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas is calling for an international conference to resolve the Mideast conflict. He said today the Palestinians are ready to work with the international community on a serious political process that leads to an independent state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, territories Israel seized in the 1967 Mideast War. Also today, Israeli forces carried out a raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. For more on the situation, I have reporter Linda Grandstein on the line. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you, Yehia.
So what is being said there about another possible extension to the ceasefire?
Well, both Israel and Hamas seem to be interested in extending that ceasefire. And Israel originally said that it was interested in extending it for another few days, as long as Hamas continues to release hostages. At the beginning, in fact, Israel came out with a list of 300 Palestinian prisoners who could be released. At the same time, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel does intend to go back to the fighting after that ceasefire ends. And in something that really just happened, the army says it's checking a claim by Hamas that one family, a father, a mother, and two very young kids, 10 months and 4 years old, who had been in Hamas captivity, and apparently Hamas had turned them over to another faction, that they had been killed. And there's no confirmation yet, but these two little boys, both, I think I even mentioned them yesterday, carrot-topped, red-headed boys, have become somehow symbols of all of the children who had been held in captivity. And so if this does turn out to be true, there's going to be a lot of anger and sadness in Israel.
President Joe Biden's administration would like to see a new extension of the ceasefire. And the official, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is expected to arrive in Israel, I think, today. And also, the United States Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, Roger Cranston, is heading that way. So is pressure building up from the American side to kind of make the ceasefire lasting?
Well, I think there is pressure, but Israel insists that it won't give in to that pressure. Israel says that the longest the ceasefire can last would be 10 days. So that would mean, you know, another 4 days after today, and that then Israel is committed to going back to the fighting. There definitely will be pressure, but what Israeli officials are saying is that if they stop the fighting now, basically that would leave Hamas in power in Gaza. And then the next round of fighting is just a matter of time, whether it's 2 years or 5 years that Hamas will rearm, will get together. At the same time, given the fact that about 15,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed and the humanitarian crisis that's been created and that half of the homes in Gaza, in northern Gaza, have been destroyed, the United States is very worried about an ongoing, you know, humanitarian crisis. I think they're at least pressuring Israel that if it does resume the fighting, to make sure that there are safe zones in the south of Gaza that Palestinians can flee to and to stay safe. But if it does go into southern Gaza, as Israeli officials keep saying they intend to do, it's going to be very difficult to avoid civilian casualties.
And talking about humanitarian crisis, the World Health Organization is warning diseases such as respiratory infections and diarrheal diseases may kill more people than the fighting in Gaza.
Yes, there's definitely concern. Look, even before this war started, Gaza is one of the poorest areas in the world. It's densely populated. There isn't good hygiene. Even before the war, the World Health Organization was saying that some 95% of the water wasn't drinkable. Now, given everything that's happened, there really is a humanitarian crisis, and people are living in very difficult conditions. All of the UN schools and shelters are completely packed with something like nine times the amount of people that they're supposed to have. I've spoken to people in Gaza who say there's, you know, four working toilets for 10,000 people. So, you know, the international community is going to have to, you know, put in huge amounts of money and is going to have to work very quickly to try to prevent the kinds of things you were talking about.
So aid is aid entering Gaza?
Yes, aid is entering Gaza, but there's such a backlog. You know, for 50 days, very little aid was getting in. And so there is water, there seems to be enough water, but in terms of medicines, in terms of cooking oil, I spoke to someone in Gaza yesterday. He told me they were cooking on wooden stoves because there was no cooking fuel. Now that's getting in, but it's also not clear how quickly it's being distributed. In other words, what kind of mechanism is there to see that flour and rice and these staples are getting to the people who need them? And it's the situation in Gaza is so chaotic. And for example, UN officials say that, you know, they've lost dozens of UN workers in both in Israeli airstrikes. So it's really hard to imagine how this humanitarian crisis is going to be solved.
Linda Grantstein in Jerusalem, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
170 world leaders and 70,000 delegates come together this week in Dubai for the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP28. Almost every country in the world will participate in talks aimed at addressing the climate crisis, limiting global temperature increases, and supporting vulnerable communities to adapt. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa's Environment Minister, Barbara Creasy, met with her counterparts from most other African countries ahead of COP28. She told reporters in Johannesburg one of Africa's priorities will be to secure funding from the Loss and Damage Fund. At COP15 in Copenhagen in 2009, rich countries committed to mobilizing $100 billion per year by 2020 to mitigate against the effects of climate change in developing countries. But since then, says Creasy, there's been little movement.
Finance. I mean, that is a major cause of distrust between developed and developing countries. We're now told that at COP28, the 100 billion will finally be realized. But we've been told that before, so we'll see. It's going to be very interesting to see whether the kind of support that developing countries need to realize their climate ambitions will be available.
If COP28 gets life-saving climate finance flowing in Dubai, says Creasy, it'll be a big win for Africa. Jake Levine is Chief Climate Officer at the United States Development Finance Corporation. The DFC bridges the gap between the US government and private companies running projects that mitigate the harmful impacts of climate change. Levine told a recent Atlantic Council event, the DFC has so far this year provided climate financing of $2.4 billion, with 33% going to Africa. He highlights Kenya, where the corporation has funded geothermal, hydro, wind and solar power projects. Levine says Kenya now gets 93% of its electricity from clean energy sources.
That in turn is attracting investment from businesses who are looking to reduce their Scope 2 emissions and reduce their carbon footprint towards net zero. That allowed us this year to commit $10 million for one of the electric motorcycle companies that we're now investing in Nairobi. This is just one, by the way. I mean, there's a proliferation of innovation happening in this space now in Kenya as a result of the infrastructure to provide zero carbon electricity.
Creasy says COP28 must deliver more money to Africa so that it's able to adapt to climate change.
We know that climate change is going to impact on food security. It's going to impact on water security. It's going to impact on health. And unless we start to invest now and we start to get help from the international community now to build climate resilience, then of course we are going to increasingly be in the loss and damage space, which is not a good place for any country to be.
Environmental activists also want African countries to live up to their commitments to phase out fossil fuels and for wealthier regions to commit financing to just energy transitions in Africa. They say most African governments are not making full commitments to renewable energy, with some, notably Africa's largest oil producer, Nigeria, and the continent's biggest coal exporter, South Africa, instead establishing new and larger fossil fuel investments. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Today, former U.S. First Lady Rosalynn Carter will be buried in her hometown of Plains, Georgia. Mrs. Carter, the wife of former President Jimmy Carter, passed away on November 19th at the age of 96. The Carters had been married 77 years. She was widely known for her global humanitarian work with her husband. Today's events are the last of 3 days of public tributes to Mrs. Carter. VOA's Ken Farbo is in the small town of Plains. I have him on the line now to tell us more about Rosalynn Carter and the tribute ceremonies. Welcome to African News Tonight, Ken.
It's wonderful to join you. Thank you.
So tell us about Rosalynn Carter and also a bit about her work in international healthcare issues and other causes.
Well, Rosalynn Carter, as First Lady of the United States, transformed the role of the wife of the President of the United States. She was someone who wanted to actively be involved in what her husband was doing, and she wanted to be knowledgeable about policy issues on behalf of the administration of the country. And so she asked her husband, Jimmy Carter, if she could join his cabinet meetings when she was First Lady. And, you know, she really set the stage for the activist role of the First Lady, the involved role of the First Lady, and she changed that role. Not only did she change the role of First Lady in the White House, she transformed the role of First Lady outside the White House. She has perhaps done more than any other First Lady prior to her, with the exception of perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt, in, as the Carter Center, which is the organization she founded, says, building hope, fighting disease, and what they do with the Carter Center and what Mrs. Carter is, as a founder of that organization, is helping to eradicate neglected tropical diseases like guinea worm, treating neglected tropical diseases like river blindness, promoting democracy, which would be the work in monitoring elections. And the cause of her life, she did this both in the White House and well beyond the White House, is addressing mental health issues, trying to remove the stigma associated with those who are dealing with mental health issues, and trying to promote treatment of those people who are suffering from mental health issues. And because of Rosalynn Carter, the world in general understands the issues of mental health illnesses and treating mental health much more because of her.
So what events are planned today there in Plains?
So today is the final day of memorial and tribute services to Mrs. Carter. This is the town in which she was born nearly a century ago, and this is the place where she will be buried. And so today in the church that she has attended for the last 40-some years, close friends and family are paying tribute to her for a final memorial service. And as the memorial service concludes, the motorcade that's carrying her casket will drive to her home, which is just at the edge of the town of Plains, Georgia, and there will be a private burial service next to the pond that is in front of their house, and that is where Rosalynn Carter will be buried.
Ken Farbo in Plains, Georgia, updating us on the tribute ceremonies for former U.S. First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Thanks for your input.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. The European Union says it can deploy election observers in the Democratic Republic of Congo because of continuing violence there. An EU spokesperson told the French news agency AFP that the security situation makes long-term observation impossible. He said the EU is considering options and is in touch with DRC authorities. An opposition party official was killed yesterday during clashes between rival political groups and the country's troubled east. Two army colonels have been charged with inciting a mutiny during Madagascar's recent presidential election. A top prosecutor and investigators say the charges were announced just days after Andry Rajoelina secured a new term as president in an election boycotted by most opposition leaders. The French news agency AFP says the two colonels were charged Monday with threatening state security. The head of the Madagascar Gendarmerie's criminal section says they acted to contest the election and destabilize power. Authorities say ahead of the election's first round on November 16th, the men offered the equivalent of about $27,500 to several army leaders so they would incite soldiers to mutiny. The two colonels are in custody until a hearing on January the 16th.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1. Then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1. Then 202-258-3076.
The 16 days of activism against gender-based violence runs through December 10th and is aimed at raising public awareness of one of the world's biggest humanitarian issues. I spoke with Sunita Kamina, UN Women Regional Policy Specialist on Ending Violence Against Women for East and Southern Africa. In part one of our conversation, she starts out by defining gender-based violence.
So at the root cause of gender-based violence is gender inequality and discrimination against women. And what we see is that this actually permeates all levels of society, right? We see that it affects this power imbalance based on gender inequalities is visible in how individuals internalize what it means to be male or female. It is reflected in how relationships take place within families, between partners. Even you can see it in peer dynamics within schools, within workplaces, within public spaces. We see it in community structures of who has positions of authority and leadership for decisions. We see it in how our laws are structured and in the social norms in society in terms of who gets protected to enjoy their basic rights and who is not protected and experiences discrimination. So at the gender-based violence in its core is around gender inequality and discrimination. And that's why it takes a multifaceted effort to actually address it.
Who is responsible for preventing gender-based violence?
The state, actually. So, you know, UN member states, there are many countries that have actually the obligation to protect individuals that live in their countries, right? And so in many constitutions, in many laws and policies, that commitment and that obligation is actually explicitly articulated. What we see not happening is that often there are these very ambitious and important commitments being made, policies, strategies, action plans, but we're not seeing them resourced adequately. We're not seeing them monitored sufficiently. And then that accountability to take action is not there. In terms of institutional, you know, obligations and responses, gender-based violence needs to involve a whole of society approach. So it's not only up to the Ministry of Gender or the Ministry responsible for women's rights, which is often an institution that doesn't receive the same level of resources as other institutions, but it also requires the highest level of leadership. It requires a multi-sectoral approach involving health, justice, education, social services. It's important to involve media, you know, finance, foreign affairs. So it needs a multi-sectoral approach. And it needs that recognition from the institutions and from leadership and community members of the obligations that exist, but also the opportunities to act and the power that they have to act.
And one of the reasons I'm talking to you is because this week there is a 16-day of activism against gender-based violence. It began last Sunday, highlighting the whole gender-based violence. Your thoughts on your message on how this thing can really be prevented?
Thank you for that. Indeed, it is the 16 days of activism, but as you said, every day, 365 days a year, needs to be a day of action. This year's theme is around investing to prevent violence against women and girls, because we know that prevention is more effective and critical as an investment to step up. Which includes responses to those who've experienced violence, but we really need to step up our actions to prevent violence against women and girls from happening in the first place. So I think the key message is that everyone has a role to play. It's important to become aware of the issues, that violence affects everyone, whether directly or indirectly. It's important to listen if someone discloses and know where the support services are in your community. It's important not to judge survivors and repeat, and to be aware of stereotypes that blame victims. And just look at, there are many, many opportunities to take action. And so in line with the theme this year where we say there's no excuse, it would be really important for everyone to take action, educate themselves, find ways to support organizations, women's rights organizations working on this issue that historically have been underfunded, and continue to speak out in support of a world where all women and girls in their diversity can live free from violence.
That was Sunita Kamina, United Nations Women Regional Policy Specialist on Ending Violence Against Women for East and Southern Africa. She spoke with me from Nairobi. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.